This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the New Books Network podcast in Asian American Studies. I'm your host, Donna Doan Anderson, and joining me in conversation today is Dr. Catherine Siniza Choi. To kick off Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, we will discuss her 2022 book, Asian American Histories of the United States. The book is a timely addition to a growing literature of comprehensive Asian American history texts that seek to highlight the nearly 200-year history of Asian migration, labor, and community formation in the United States. Not an impossible task for Choi, who identifies pivotal years in Asian American history as the focus of her 8 chapters. This conversation will just scratch the surface of her study, which includes the beginning of Asian exclusionary policies with the Page Law in 1875, the rapid changes of 1965 and 1969, which saw a growing Asian America in understanding and demographics, to 2020 and the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. In just 175 pages, Choi weaves together the layered histories of exclusion, violence, and resistance to rectify the generalizations that come from a, quote, misunderstanding of Asian Americans and their history, end quote. Something that I personally enjoyed was Choi's decision to invert the chronology, beginning with 2020 and ending with 1869. This choice is a refreshing reminder that history is just as much about the present as it is about the past. Catherine Siniza Choi is an award-winning Asian American historian and professor of ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley. She is the author of Global Families, A History of Asian International Adoption in America, and Empire of Care, Nursing and Migration in Filipino American History, which won the 2003 American Journal of Nursing History and Public Policy Book Award and the 2005 Association for Asian American Studies History Book Award. An engaged public scholar, Choi has been interviewed in many media outlets, including ABC's 2020, The Atlantic, CNN, The Los Angeles Times, NBC News, and Vox, about the history of anti-Asian hate and violence, as well as the connections between racism and misogyny. Without further ado, let's get this conversation started.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here with you.
Yeah, this is a really perfect time to have this conversation as we're approaching Asian American Heritage Month. And so to be able to discuss Asian American histories of the United States with you is such an honor. And I thought maybe to start our conversation, we could talk a little bit about how you came to this book and what influenced this project, especially because it departs from your previous research-focused academic monographs, Empire of Care, which was published in 2003, and Global Families, which was published in 2013. So yeah, could you give us a sense of like what influenced you to write Asian American Histories of the United States?
The main influence of my writing Asian American Histories of the United States had to do with my over 20 years experience of teaching Asian American studies and specifically Asian American history in the classroom. My first tenure track position was in American Studies at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. And I've been a professor of ethnic studies at UC Berkeley since 2004. So these are important public university settings, but I also wanted to share Asian American history with a broader audience that may not necessarily be able to be in my classroom. So that certainly was a major motivation. And I had this terrific opportunity To be part of Beacon Press's revisioning history series and to do a book in that series about Asian American history. And so I agreed to do that. And again, one of the reasons why I really wanted that opportunity was to write for the broadest audience possible, an audience who was interested in Asian American history, but may not have had that opportunity to take an ethnic studies or Asian American history class in college. And as you pointed out, my first two books, Empire of Care, which was about Filipino nurses and their migration to the United States. And then my second book, Global Families, A History of Asian International Adoption in America, were written primarily for academic audiences, even though, of course, I also want a broad audience for that. But as a professor, that's part of my job, to research and create historical knowledge in an academic setting. So that was, for me, I think one of the highlights of my work as a scholar, but this particular book, Asian American Histories of the United States, gave me the chance to do something different and to write differently.
Yeah, and I'm sure no doubt that that was a challenge too, because to write for these different audiences requires a certain attention and care. But yet I found this book to be so timely to this particular moment, and we'll get to that a little bit later in the conversation. But I thought, as a kind of follow-up question to thinking about this book and your choices in writing it, this book kind of joins another line of comprehensive Asian American history texts, such as Ron Takaki's Strangers of a Different Shore, Erica Lee's Making of Asian America, and then more recently, Huping Ling's Asian American History. So how do you see this book fitting into this trajectory of Asian American history? And what interpretations did you hope to introduce into this historiography?
That's a great question. I am certainly indebted to Asian American historians and the Asian American studies community as a whole. I wouldn't have been able to be in academia and teach Asian American history and write these books without that history of Asian American scholars before me. In some ways, I see this as a conversation with them that complements their work and is also incredibly grateful for their work. I think the opportunity that I had in this book was how to frame and reframe Asian American history for the broadest audience possible. And Asian American history is so rich because Asian America is so diverse, and we have a centuries-long history, that at this point in time, in 2024, as we're speaking, it's really challenging, if not impossible, to write one book that can reflect this community's history. In many ways, this is a living history. It's dynamic and it changes over time. And so I learned from previous scholars certain benefits for taking a group by group. By group by group, I mean Asian ethnic group one and then another and so forth, and kind of that approach. And then different kinds of thematic approaches to Asian American history, rethinking also place as well as time, so hemispheric approaches, transnational approaches. And I wanted to, in my book, really emphasize a couple of things which I had felt had not been as emphasized before. The first was that there are still many Asian American ethnic groups who are not fully visible and represented in Asian American history. And so I wanted to pay more attention to these groups' experiences. So groups like Filipino, Korean, South Asian, mixed race Asian Americans, adoptees, specific occupational groups like nurses. So adoptees and nurses certainly were the focus of my first two scholarly books, but I had not seen them as integrated in other kinds of syntheses of Asian American history. So I wanted to pay attention to that. Secondly, I wanted to honor Asian American communities' diversity by making the point that there are Asian American histories and that there isn't a singular Asian American history that can encompass everyone. And this idea of multiple origin points in Asian American histories. And so the way I organize the book is by having each chapter focus on a particular calendar year that is speaking to a distinctive origin of Asian American history, whether it's the year 2020 or the year 1975, 1968, 1953, and so on. At the same time that I wanted to recognize and honor Asian American communities' diversity, I also wanted to emphasize in my book that there are still thematics and there are still common experiences that bring us together. And the three themes that I focus on in the book, violence, erasure, and resistance, are just some of the major themes that still give Asian American history's relevance and meaning.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you just left with this idea of these three themes of violence, erasure, and resistance, and how for, you know, those listeners who might not be as familiar with Asian American studies, this is, you know, really three themes that we see regularly in Asian American studies scholarship, right? There are key interventions, key points of analysis. And you also mentioned about how you fix your eight chapters of the book around these years. One thing that I absolutely loved about this book was that you inverted that. We start with 2020 and then we move backwards. And I found that to be kind of a really refreshing way to engage with history, not just in the sense of the themes that you're talking about, but like really to see the kind of legacies of a lot of these events and legislation on our communities. And so I think with, you know, thinking about the way you've organized this book around the three interconnected roles of violence, erasure, and resistance, as well as the organization of your eight chapters around these notable years in Asian American history, you know, how is the present political moment kind of informing the way that you thought through this organization? And particularly one thing that I'm going to selfishly ask is about why the understanding of gender and race is so pivotal to understanding anti-Asian violence and American history, because I thought this intersection of violence and misogyny that you present throughout the book to be a really compelling one. So could you tell us a little bit about how you use race and gender throughout the book, how it might relate to these three interconnected themes, and maybe some examples of how that comes to play, especially in this kind of present moment?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Yeah, I wrote this book primarily during the years 2020 and 2021. And so even though I had started writing the book before those years, and it's certainly, as I had mentioned earlier, a reflection of over 20 years of teaching Asian American history, I was really influenced by the years of the COVID-19 pandemic. without a doubt. And then when the March 2021 Atlanta spa shootings took place, in which six of the eight victims were Asian American women, that was certainly an event that I think raised a very critical and emotional awareness among Asian Americans, including myself. I'm the daughter of Filipino immigrants, and my Asian American identity is very important to me. And so during the COVID-19 pandemic, the surge in anti-Asian violence, the surge in anti-Asian coronavirus-related hate was something that I, like so many Asian Americans in our present day, confronted and dealt with. And I think those two events, in terms of when you were referring to our present political moment, were very influential in writing the book. Because even though I, like many other Asian American historians and Asian American studies scholars, understood that the anti-Asian violence that we were witnessing and experiencing in 2020 was not new, it had become clear to so many of us that the general public, especially the American public as a whole, was quite unaware of this longer history of anti-Asian violence. And so certainly that's why it was the present moment of COVID-19, as well as the fact that, yes, many of us as scholars have featured anti-Asian violence in our work, that I focused on that theme. So I want to connect it, though, with your question about the intersection of race and gender, because when one studies and when one experiences anti-Asian violence, one has to recognize that misogyny and anti-Asian violence against Asian American women is part, a central part of that historical theme. And there's a way that I think many of us, especially here in the United States, I'll make a generalization here. You know, we're part of a culture that's very forward-looking, individualistic, and we want to believe that over time there's going to be progress. Now, I know as scholars, we're also critics, so I know we can take that apart. But I think in general, there's still those kinds of wishes, you know, about the future and change over time, and wanting to see that progress. And I think what made anti-Asian violence during COVID-19 and then the Atlanta spa shootings so incredibly painful was that intersecting with the violence was this, I think, recognition or confrontation with how much work Asian American studies scholars need to continue to do to inform and educate the general American public. The fact that during the Atlanta spa shootings, that a sheriff would emphasize that the shooter communicated that race had nothing to do with it, and that he was having a really bad day, was something that struck me, as well as many of my Asian American Studies colleagues, in a very painful way. And it was very difficult for myself and so many of us as scholars to speak with the media at that point in time. But I felt that it was, in a way, a moral as well as intellectual obligation to do that, because there was still this disentanglement of race and gender that was historically and in the present moment inaccurate. And I could say more about this. You know, I could say this goes back to events like the, you know, Watsonville riots of the 1930s, where, you know, at that point in time, it was anti-Filipino male violence because of the sexual threat that they had posed to white American men in terms of white women. So there's ways that the Atlanta Spa shootings was certainly not exceptional, but it was definitely on my mind, and one that I think of regarding the intersection of race and gender. And the final thing I'll say is, when I was writing Empire of Care, one of the unique chapters in that book was focused on mass murders. One of those murder cases I talked about was the third Speck case in Chicago from the mid-1960s, in which he murdered a number of student nurses, including two Filipino exchange nurses. And the only survivor was a Filipino exchange nurse, Corazon Amara, who survived and then was brave enough to testify against Speck. And I've been inspired by this history, and specifically Amara's bravery. And I thought about that as I was giving interviews and writing about the Atlanta Spa shootings in this most recent book.
Yeah, and I really like how you've grounded yourself so much in this analysis. And for those who haven't read Asian American Histories of the United States, one thing that I found really compelling in each of these chapters was that you continued to return us back to almost your personal experiences and your engagements with each of these moments of, or this particular moment, the 2020 to 2021 moment, which you're writing in this book. And you know, one of the other things that I thought was really interesting about the book in general, beyond highlighting these kind of major moments, right, are these personal engagements, right? You do a great job of creating these weavings of major immigration policy to kind of regional politics, to then kind of the interpersonal stories within communities, whether that be from narratives of community members, or like I had mentioned, even your own experiences and your reflections within this text. And there are examples of this in every chapter, which I highly recommend listeners to read and to check out and to really think about. But for me, actually, one of the parts of the book that I found to be really interesting to read was the interlude. And it's called 1965 Reprise, The Face Behind the Food. And in this interlude, you provide separate dedications to individuals and groups that created or contributed to the development of Asian American food cultures. And it almost stood out to me as like a love letter to each of these different individuals or these different communities that you kind of trace through time, of course, thinking about a reprise of 1965. So could you tell me a little bit about what inspired you to write this interlude in this way? especially because it stands out so against kind of the narrative that you present in the other chapters?
Yes, thank you for saying that. In many ways, it reads like a love letter. Other people have told me that it reads like a shout out poem. And it is written in a very different way. I mean, even the idea of an interlude in a history book is very unusual. We're kind of more familiar with that in terms of some kind of cultural art form, like a play. So I did this because, similar to the inverted chronology that you had mentioned earlier, I did this because 1965 is such a rich and fascinating origin year for Asian American histories. And in the book, there is one chapter that features 1965, but specifically in relation to the Immigration Act of 1965, which was a watershed in U.S. immigration as well as Asian American history, and is known for creating a more equitable system of immigration, which finally did away with so many different exclusionary policies against Asian Americans before 1965. And then the Immigration Act of 1965 gave rise to a much more socioeconomically diverse Asian America, with the highly educated professional communities that we see, as well as the persistence of working class and vulnerable immigrants in our Asian American communities. So 1965 is also an important origin year because it's the year of the UFWs, the United Farm Workers strike against grape growers, which was started by a Filipino-American labor leader, Larry Itliong, and Filipino-American farm workers. And the thing is that it's often difficult to integrate these histories in a smooth linear fashion. And I think that's one there. I mean, absolutely, you know, chronology is one of the strengths of our discipline in history. But at the same time, we also need to be critical that sometimes chronology and this linear moving forward in time can sometimes give one the impression that one thing led to another, and that history works in this singular linear fashion. But oftentimes there are different kinds of histories that are intersecting and can't be integrated smoothly together. So rather than, you know, include, let's say, Larry Itliong and Filipino-American farm workers striking against grapes in this chapter on immigration, I thought it needs to stand on its own terms. And it gave me this opportunity to acknowledge, or as you point out, to really show love and appreciation for the many different ways that various groups of Asian Americans over time have grown, harvested, prepared American food for the general American public, and have been innovative and have made incredible sacrifices, you know, in terms of their bodies because of how difficult it is to do farm work and to produce food. And I took a risk. I took a risk and created this interlude to give that love and acknowledgement and try to honor these different groups. And it goes from Chinese workers who made swampland in the state of California arable. The interlude also pays recognition to Hawaiian cafeteria ladies, quote unquote ladies, as they were called, because it was a gendered form of work, which many women participated in. Certainly to the farm workers who grew grapes and up until 2020 with the creation of organizations like Heart of Dinner, which was created by Asian Americans to provide hot meals and love and comfort and support to Asian American elders in New York City. So thank you for just pointing this out, because it's one of my favorite parts of the book.
And it's one of my favorite parts of the book, to be clear. I do think it's so refreshing to read it in that way. And like you said, that love and that community care that you are showing really comes out in the words of that interlude. And so I really thought I couldn't miss an opportunity to ask you about it, because I do think that, you know, we sometimes do get bogged down by these kind of major historical events or major historical themes without actually spending the time to acknowledge the amount of labor that goes into the life that we currently have, right? And so I think this is a really great way to think about the concept of Asian American, right? And in chapter three, which focuses on 1968, hinging around the Third World Liberation movements and student activist movements that generated this term Asian American. And you ask this question in a very kind of Shakespearean way, what is in the name of Asian American? And, you know, as I'm thinking about this conversation that we've had, as we've talked through different themes, as we've talked about creative ways to engage with Asian American history and its chronology and to challenge these linear narratives that you're saying, I do kind of return to this question that you pose, which is, what is in the name of Asian American? And especially because this book is so deeply informed by the moment that you're writing this, right? 2020, 2021. Now that we're a few years out from the pandemic, would you respond differently, right? Would there be a different answer to what is in the name Asian American? Or perhaps, what do we think about when we move forward? Where do we go from here?
Insightful questions. And I'm going to answer that question. Would I have responded differently if I were, let's say, writing in 2024? I'm going to respond with both no and yes. And let me explain why. Part of the reason why I would say no is because that particular chapter, What's in the Name Asian American, and its focus on 1968, that chapter has several key points I wanted to make. But one of those points is how in the 21st century, in general, we take the term Asian American for granted. As though it's been, you know, somehow always with us. And the way that the general public tends to understand this term Asian American is typically referring to a person, an American person with Asian heritage or, you know, of Asian descent. And people are most familiar with it through institutions and such as the census forms that we fill out. It becomes a box of identity that we check off. And I wouldn't change that chapter because I would still want people to know that the term Asian American is a term with a history. And that has these themes of violence, erasure, and resistance behind it. And that it was specifically created in the late 1960s by two UC Berkeley graduate students, Yuji Ichioka and Emma G, when they helped found the Asian American Political Alliance. And how this term was so meaningful for them, because it was a rejection of previous terms of identity that were used to refer to Asian Americans, but were typically racial slurs like Jap or Gook, or were terms like Oriental, which reinforced these stereotypes of perpetual foreignness and could also commodify Asian and Asian American bodies. So to say we're going to resist that and name ourselves in a way that acknowledges our Asian Americanness as a whole, you know, as a holistic identity, and also one that has a political sensibility of that time, that it was not simply about identity, but it was also about a new kind of political and racial solidarity across different Asian American ethnic groups who had not necessarily seen themselves as Asian American. And that it was also about political racial solidarity with other racialized groups, whether Chicanos and American Indians and African Americans, which you were referring to with the Third World Liberation Front and those solidarity movements. I think it's important for all of us today and going forward to know and understand that, even if it may not necessarily jibe with our individual, you know, identities and politics. But that is one of the most important legacies, I think, of the Asian American movement, was to reject identities that had been, and often denigrating identities that had been imposed on us, that had dehumanized us. And to create our own ways of being and belonging in the world. So no, I wouldn't change it, because that's important in that chapter. That chapter also connects to a theme of Black and Asian American solidarity and how there's a longer history to that. It doesn't begin in 1968, and it doesn't end there either. and I would want all of us in the 21st century and beyond to remember that. So that's why I say no. Here's why I also say yes. I say yes because, as I mentioned earlier, Asian American histories are living histories. They're dynamic. And our identity formations, I think, are individual as well as collective. And they're informed by changing contexts of time and place and our interests and passions and commitments. And so, yes, I would write about it differently because as time went on, because we continue as human beings to grow and to think of ourselves differently. And so I'm often, when I talk about the book to live audiences, I'm often asked questions about identity formation, and audience members often share with me their concerns about the term Asian American and how do they belong? Do they belong? They don't think they belong. And I think all of these things are important to acknowledge.
Absolutely. And I love the kind of leaving on the question that Asian American is so dynamic. And, you know, I can't wait for the second iteration of Asian American Histories of the United States, maybe another chapter or two, whatever the next pivotal years will be. So it'd be fascinating to see how this project can continue. And, you know, something that I was even thinking about with my students was having them identify specific years that for their personal histories, they can make these kind of connections, right? And so I thought this was just such a great way of presenting such a comprehensive, literally nearly 200 years of Asian American history in such a condensed and approachable and public-facing way. So thank you for this book. It's excellent. And I almost feel bad asking the question, what's next, right? You know, I think the New Books Network loves to know, you know, what kinds of topics you're interested in now and like what projects we can look forward to from the future. Again, not discrediting the amazing work that this book has provided for us, but if you could give us a sense of, you know, what is piquing your interest these days and what are you thinking of working on next?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to thank you for sharing the book with your students. And the question that you would pose to your students, like, what's an origin year for you in your Asian American history, is exactly what I wanted to come from this book, is to ask more questions. To be able to explore more Asian American history. So thank you so much for that. There are some new things regarding this specific book, which I wanted to mention. There's a forthcoming Japanese translation of the book, which will be out later this year. And I'm so excited for this book to gain a global audience. So it's very meaningful for me. Also, Sarah Park Dahlin and Sun Yang Shin will be adapting the book for a young adult audience. And I'm also looking forward to having younger readers engage with these histories. In terms of what's new, for me, regarding research, I think that's always a fun question. So I'm glad you asked it. I'm currently writing a book of essays also for Beacon Press about myths about Asian Americans. So false notions regarding Asian Americans being perpetual foreigners and model minorities. And I'm writing it for also a broad audience. And I've also started doing research and writing for a biography on a Filipina food scientist, Maria Ilagana Rosa, who was born in the late 19th century. And tragically passed away during World War II in the Philippines. But she is most famous for inventing the condiment banana ketchup, which is beloved by not solely Filipinos in the Philippines, but Filipinos and many other people in the diaspora. And she received her bachelor's of science and master's of science degrees here in the United States because the Philippines was an official U.S. colony. And so this for me is like a new direction regarding biography, Asian American women, and food and environmental studies. And I see some key issues in our time regarding certainly climate change and food security, and the need for conservation and sustainability. And I hope that my biography of Maria Laguna Rosa will be one of several biographies I hope to do in this area.
Wow, banana ketchup sounds very interesting. I can't say that I've tried it myself, but I would not hesitate to, because
I'm going to send you some.
Please do. I would love to try some. You know, anyway, it's kind of the Midwestness in me and thinking about ranch dressing as well. Maybe there's a banana ranch. All that said, thank you so much, Kathy, for joining me in conversation today, for providing this text for us, and particularly as we're thinking, moving into May, right, responding to and remembering the legacies and the peoples that have come before us. And yeah, it's been a wonderful conversation. I can't believe our hour has already passed, but thank you so much for being here and being in conversation with me today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you too.